This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeblet.
And I'm Yannick Magnan.
And what's our topic for this week, Yannick?
Destiny and the live service mindset.
Ooh. And this week, in one of our rare week, we don't have follow-up. So we'll go directly into your main topic.
Great. So before people start clicking out of the episode...
That's a way to sell. To sell it.
I'm sure there are a bunch of people listening who don't know anything about Destiny or who aren't software developers. So I just want you to be aware before you click out of the episode that this episode is more about the logistics of shipping a software product and less about the specifics of Destiny or software development. So I think there's a little something that you can learn no matter what your level is.
Right. So you'll use it as an example of one of those strategies, is my understanding.
Yeah. We're Perfect. Actually going to be talking about a GDC talk that was given by the developers of Destiny. But first, I want to set the stage a little bit. So 2022 was the most successful year in the Destiny franchise. It had the highest critical and community reception in the series ever. It was the strongest business year in the history of the franchise, which was surprising because usually you don't see that. But it was 8 years after the start of the franchise, which was still a pretty big deal. 2023, on the other hand, is currently off to a bad start. Coming off of the highs of last year's Witch Queen expansion, this year's expansion, Lightfall, really underdelivered for some people. And this is the 9th year of a 10-year storyline, so there's a lot of pressure to end it right. And if you look at the Steam reviews for Lightfall, they are at low scores we have not seen since very early Destiny 2 and the lows of the Curse of Osiris expansion, which almost killed the franchise altogether. So while I was personally playing through Lightfall myself, I was very excited for it at the start of the month. I kept thinking of a talk given by Justin Truman, the general manager of Destiny 2 at last year's game developer conference, which amazingly, like I didn't plan this, but game developer conference is literally ongoing right now, this year's edition, but last year's GDC, they gave this talk called From Bucks Products to Live Service, How Destiny 2 Transformed Bungie. And as the name implies, the talk focuses on how live service games like Destiny require a complete shakeup in how you develop games. And I originally heard about this this talk back in November, December. A YouTuber called Astacross, who does a lot of Destiny content, uploaded basically... because for context, GDC has all of these talks, and usually they'll release a few of them on what they call the GDC Vault, where you can watch them for a couple weeks and then they go back in the vault and you have to pay a GDC membership if you want to watch all of these things. So Astacross basically did the great thing of reading the entire transcript out on YouTube so you don't have to actually sign up for GDC and shared it with all of his subscribers. And that is how I got to hear the talk. And yeah, when I first heard it, I thought it was really interesting how I agreed with a lot of it as a software developer. But if I put on my gamer hat, I had a completely different set of reactions. Mm. And now with the whole context surrounding how the Lightfall expansion is not so great and the quality of recent seasonal content drops, I think a lot of the issues in the game today can be traced back to various things that they themselves touted as being part of their new strategy during this presentation. So that's what I want to talk about today on the show. And I'm going to start off by sort of explaining the context around vanilla Destiny 2.
I'm really eager to hear your developer side arguing or kind of being having different opinion than your gamer side. I think we'll have a good show just because of that.
Yeah. So Destiny 2 was born out of a commitment to their publisher, which was Activision at the time, that Bungie would make a sequel to Destiny 3 years after launch. And just to interject before we go any further, like if you're not at all familiar with what Destiny is a first-person shooter that has a massively multiplayer online game elements, which means you are in a large shared world with other players, and you can get into groups of 3 or 6 to do various activities together. And while you're out with your group doing those activities, you will run into other groups of 3 or 6 or solo players, I guess, around the map. So it's kind of like this sort of open world game spread across many different planets with a variety of different activities you can do, most of which involve shooting other players or other enemies. This was not really seen prior to Destiny. You saw games that were massively multiplayer online games, but they generally were not first-person shooters. So Destiny was kind of the innovator with that, and they risked a lot in trying to do that game. And what's very rare with massively online games, massively multiplayer online games, is that you very rarely see them have sequels, like numbered sequels. Usually you just get expansions until the game dies or it just doesn't die. Like look at World of Warcraft. It's been around since 2004, still getting expansions. Until people stop playing it, it's going to keep getting expansions. Final Fantasy XI, hilariously enough, this is like a 2003 MMORPG, I think. It predates World of Warcraft. This week they said, Square Enix said, yeah, we sort of feel bad for keeping developers maintaining this like 20-year-old game and limiting their career development potential. So we decided to let a few of them just go work on other games, and we are downsizing our development team. But this is a 20-year-old MMO game that's still being maintained. So, you know, like it's kind of wild that if you think the original plan was after 3 years of Destiny 1, we're going to have a Destiny 2, you also never really see that. And it's kind of strange.
Right. And isn't it like the big distinction, like with the example you mentioned of WoW, is I remember when I first heard of that game in the early 2000s, like, be careful, you might enjoy this game, but then you're stuck paying for a subscription to continue playing this game forever. Explains kind of this, we having more or less the last 10, 15 years of just recurring updates, recurring patches, because players that keep playing for the game are required to pay to do that.
Yeah, they pay their subscription and they pay for the expansion, which is
that's true.
Kind of wild when
that.
You think about it, whereas Destiny... Destiny for all of the stuff, like you don't pay a subscription, but you basically have the opportunity to buy expansions every year and 4 seasons a year. That is, and microtransactions, I guess, if you want cosmetic items on top of that. But otherwise, you're not paying for access to Destiny itself. In fact, it's free to play.
Right, and that wasn't like even these. Expansion model was not part of the first game, or am I missing something?
The expansion model was part of the first game. The seasonal okay. stuff came in Destiny 2, and we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah, I was sure about the seasonal, but not the expansions.
Yeah, that's sort of the idea. Destiny 2, 3 years after Destiny, that was the original plan. I think actually the original plan was to do it after 2 years, because there was a leaked PowerPoint presentation that basically showed like. We're going to have the first year with 2 minor expansions, then we're going to have a major expansion, which they called a comet, and then we're going to have the sequel the year after that. And they missed their target, and they had to put a little major expansion in the middle of that, which was Rise of Iron, if you were a Destiny 1 player. It's complex, and there were a lot of unpredictable turns in the story of Destiny early on, not the in-game story, but the development story of Destiny early on, just because nobody had ever really done this before. And if you remember back to Destiny 1 had a bad reputation due to a lot of early mistakes, because again, they had no idea what they were doing, and also because most of its player base after the initial launch was pretty hardcore. And I include myself in there, like, just to brag about how much I played Destiny 1. I have, like, 960-something hours in Destiny 1 over 3 years. And I came in late to the game. Well, late. I came in between vanilla Destiny 1 launch and the first expansion. But basically what I mean is I wasn't there for the betas. I wasn't there at launch. I came in after a couple months after the launch of the game. So one of the design goals going into Destiny 2 was to make it much more widely appealing. So they gave it a much, much better campaign. They gave the game much more generous rewards. They wanted to do a lot of stuff to justify putting a 2 on the box and reset expectations from Destiny 1. And if you actually look at the box art for Destiny 2, the 2 on the box is the size of the box. It is the largest visual element of the game. That is how focal the 2 was to Destiny 2. And interestingly, like, review scores seem pretty favorable to the improvements they made in the game. And I think if you look at it immediately after launch and having beaten the campaign, a lot of players felt similarly. Like, I had a regular group of players I was playing with, and a lot of people felt pretty positively, like, immediately after beating the campaign. And Bungie basically said data showed that there were more players engaging with the game for longer hours within the first 6 weeks of the game. So mission accomplished, right? They got good reviews. They got wider appeal. What could possibly go wrong? Well, very quickly, the most hardcore players in the community were running out of shit to do in the game. And it didn't take very long for this problem to spread to more casual players, too. I remember this very clearly. I was raiding with my friends, and raiding is one of the most enjoyable things, but I was like already telling people, like, on my second week of raiding, like, I don't think I have anything I can do in this game once we beat this raid. There's just nothing to do. And it eventually caught up to the other people who were at the time logging less hours than me in Destiny, because of that was pretty much all I was doing at the time. And that's a real problem. So Destiny 1 may have been a very polarizing game, and I think it's very justified that it was polarizing. Just to be clear, I really like Destiny 1, and I like it more than a lot of Destiny 2, but I fully acknowledge and understand that it was not a game for everyone, and it was very much made for my brainworms. But one thing it did have is it had the ability to captivate a very dedicated audience. Destiny 2 put all of its eggs into the initial 20-hour basket, and it did not have much to retain anyone beyond that. And ultimately, that ended up threatening the future of the entire game. Just an aside before I go into how that threatened the game, I think Destiny is a really hard game to review, because when you're reviewing the game, you're playing through the campaign, and ultimately, most of what people do in Destiny is hundreds of hours of grinding on other shit after the campaign. And you're not going to fit that into your review period. So it's incredibly hard. Like, I think if you just look objectively at the Destiny 2 campaign, you can give that a score, but it does not mean that Destiny is going to be a compelling game 6 weeks later at all. And that's a real hard thing for reviewers to adapt with live service games. I know that Polygon for a while was doing like this like provisional review score thing, where they were like, this is our review for the campaign. We will update this review in 2 months after we have played Destiny for like 100 hours or whatever, just to give it a better idea of like what the game is long term. And I think it's really hard for that kind of stuff to review. And I think more recently, they don't even give review copies of the game to anyone anymore, because they want everyone to experience everything at the same time. And the whole weird logistics of how do you review a game like Destiny, where you are sort of meant to make it part of your lifestyle, is really, really difficult. Anyway, done with that distraction. Destiny 2 launched in September of 2017. By February of 2018, the player population drop-off was so significant that if that drop-off continued for 5 more weeks, Destiny 2 would have no players.
Whoa.
This naturally terrified Bungie, because they were 1 month away from shutting the whole game down. And Bungie claims that they recovered from this catastrophe by embracing what they call a live service mindset, which is the topic of this episode, instead of a box product mindset. So let's define what that means. Starting, of course, with box product mindset. So Bungie's previous franchise, Halo, was massively successful. It was critically well-regarded. It had broad popular appeal. It was culturally relevant. And players engaged with it for a very long time with no balance patches or upgrades or anything, really. So by every imaginable metric, Halo was successful. Destiny 1 was the first Bungie game in over 10 years that did not launch to universal acclaim. In many ways, they thought it was a failure, but in hindsight, Destiny 1 was a success in a lot of ways that mattered. They didn't really think that player engagement was a measure of success back then. And in trying to fix the failures of Destiny 1 with Destiny 2, they realized they had an incorrect internal definition of success. As long as you have player engagement, reviews, player sentiment, and sales can be corrected. Anger and love for a game both come from a place of passion. from players who are highly engaged. Trust me, I have written a lot of thousand-word essays on forums about why Destiny 2 sucks right now. It's because I love the game that I used to play. So the opposite of loving a game is not anger, it's apathy. It's not caring about the game. That is a lot more dangerous to your game than anger. Because if you actually end up pleasing the people who are angry, you can turn that around. From Halo to Destiny 2 launch, this was more or less the Bungie process that made up their box product mindset. They hired the best talent, they gave them creative freedom to make the best game possible, they released that product with a massive marketing push, and they would trust that success by every definition would follow. And like, this is pretty much the thing, is especially if you made the Halo series, like, you would believe that because they didn't really release a flop for the entire time that they actually worked on the Halo series before handing it off to 343, which kind of fucked up the entire thing. There is no perfect strategy. Like, there's no recipe to making a perfect game. And I think it's possible that Bungie might have just gotten lucky all of those times. Like, it's sure that they had a lot of skill and they put a lot of their skill into their games and they had a very good sense for when the game was polished enough to ship. But even with all of that, sometimes you're going to ship stinkers, and it doesn't mean just because you never shipped a stinker during Halo that you're not ever going to ship one, right? They believe that if you made games that you would want to play, and by trusting your gut on making something awesome, you could achieve all the success you could ever want. If only life could be this simple. I think Bungie is kind of oversimplifying a little bit here, but sure, go with it. Core to the box product mindset is the goal to exceed your expectations in every way imaginable. Scale, polish, quality. They want the game to feel essentially perfect. Making something great is about iterating through failure after failure until you have something incredible. And they compared this to Pixar, which basically does the same thing for movies internally, is they just have a very good sense for like what the creative process should be behind closed doors and iterating on things until it's polished enough to show. And doing that iteration behind closed doors until you release a near perfect product is essentially that box product mindset. Then they start talking about what the live service mindset is. And this is honestly the first time I listened to this, I found it very upsetting, but it's not false. The live service mindset is about being fast, first and foremost. Being fast is more important than anything, including quality. In 2010, you could ship a long-lasting, high-retention game with something of really high quality that was well-balanced, that was most importantly unchanged, and players would keep coming back to it year after year. I imagine they're talking about Halo 3 here. Where basically, like, they didn't really make balanced patches to Halo 3. They just shipped a really good game one day, and people kept playing it, and they are still playing it, I guess, on Xbox 360. It's just a game that they polished for a really long time, and they shipped it, and it was great. In today's world, that doesn't work. You need to constantly feed your players upgrades, updates and content, respond to player concerns, and make the game better. If box products are in the business of over-delivery, live service products are in the business of constant delivery. And this is where Bungie got their new internal motto, which is, velocity is more important than position. The position is your game's quality right now. The velocity is how quickly can you change that position. If your players run out of content, how quickly can you put it into the game? This is something that Destiny 1 players will be very familiar with, where Destiny 1 famously had content droughts for like 6 months out of the year, where there was not a major expansion on the way anytime soon. So you just were going to replay the same stuff you've been playing for the last 6 months over and over again, because that is all you have to play with. And honestly, like, I found that really fun because there was a lot of shit in Destiny at the time. And there were so many different play styles to explore in every different activity that if you don't like necessarily being guided down a specific path and you just want to mess around with shit, there's a lot of shit to mess around with in Destiny 1. But for a lot of people who prefer more guided experiences, these content droughts were very demotivating to play the game. If there's a metagame balance issue or exploit, how quickly can you patch it? This was another pain point in, well, it still is a pain point in Destiny 2 to some extent, but in Destiny 1 there was a whole year where two guns were dominating the PvP metagame, and they kind of didn't really do anything until the next major expansion where they nerfed everything into the ground. Ideally, you would want to deal with that much faster before your competitive PvP community decides to go play something else. And for a lot of Destiny 2's lifespan, that threat was Battle Royale games. If the community has a complaint about, like, whatever systems in the game or whatever, how quickly can you respond to that? So Bungie would much rather be fast than perfect. A fast game will inevitably, this is not my words, this is theirs, will inevitably become great over time. But a game that is currently great but slow to react will fall behind. And I saw this in the last year with Multiversus. Multiversus was a Warner Brothers Smash clone of sorts, where they were putting together like Game of Thrones and Looney Tunes and a bunch of other characters all together into a single fighting game. And they had this really cool season one, and then their roadmap kind of just stopped out of nowhere. And you were like, well, wait, what are you doing? Where's the updates? You just launched this game. You can't just stop the updates like 3 months into the game and not have anything for your players if you're touting this as a big game as a service. So like, there are definitely examples of games like that out there where 99% of the player base just evaporates because you just don't appear to be committed to maintaining your game. And we've seen this also on the App Store, right? Sometimes you see an app hasn't had an update in like 3 years, and you're like, probably not going to buy that one on the App Store because right. It doesn't appear to be actively maintained. That doesn't mean that it's not perfectly capable of doing its job and working great. Although, like, knowing what we know about how iOS works, that's unlikely. But still, it doesn't mean anything negative in itself. It's just it doesn't give a good vibe if you're expecting everything to be actively maintained all the time. And this whole fast approach also de-emphasizes the importance of launch. Instead of having the best possible game at launch, you should be focusing on your roadmap and tooling for the year after launch instead. This is especially funny if you know the Deep Dark Destiny 1 history, where apparently it used to take 6 hours to launch the map editor for Destiny 1, wow. Which is one of the reasons why we apparently did not have that many new environments in Destiny 1, was just like, it literally takes us 6 hours to load the map, which I think Destiny 2 has retooled a lot of that because we're seeing a lot more rapid iteration now, and that's great. And ultimately, like, Bungie is asking themselves, well, out of a service game or a box product game, which of these games will be relevant 12 months later? And to be honest, if you look at a lot of AAA games, there aren't that many AAA games that manage to stay in the zeitgeist 12 months later. Like, in recent history, I can think of maybe Elden Ring. I mean, it's kind of cheating if there's a re-release of the game, so I wouldn't really count like Death Stranding or something like that, where Death Stranding Director's Cut came out almost exactly a year later. That's kind of cheating. Like, The Last of Us kind of always stays in the zeitgeist because it's just attracting all the discourse constantly as a giant discourse magnet. But, like, I can't think of very many games that are still relevant 12 months later, or at least actively being discussed by a lot of people 12 months later. And I totally understand that if you're trying to be culturally relevant and sort of be this thing people are constantly talking about, yes, a live service game is definitely going to get you there. And Bungie ultimately admits, like, all live service games suck at launch. And this is true. I've seen so many of them. It's always true. They all suck at launch. But that's okay to them. Launch is not the end of your journey. It's the start. And my personal interpretation of the live service mindset is, because you're trying to be fast, more of your creative process is happening in production instead of behind closed doors. There's still iteration behind closed doors, but if things aren't perfect in time for a release, you should ship it as it is and fix it later. And we'll be returning to that notion a little bit later, because they literally say that later in the talk. And, like, naturally, because more of your creative process is happening in public and in production, It means people are going to see less polished things that you would have iterated over in private. And that's scary. And you sort of have to get comfortable with that if you're doing a live service game. So let's talk about redefining the metrics of success. Bungie used to be about being perfect, like we said, impeccable, uncriticizable, all of these things from the box product era. But Bungie has cast that aside. Now they're all about being fast. But part of being fast is being comfortable with failures that would have only happened internally. Ultimately, like, they don't want to let the quest for perfection stifle creativity. Most game developers, like in the AAA space, will measure success one of two ways. Either quality, which is measured by review scores and awards, and reach, which is measured by unit sales, financial success, and cultural notoriety. How do you measure success in a live service mindset? And I'm going to ask the question to you, Luca, because I'm curious to know what you think as someone who is less in the bubble than me.
So, what's the metrics of success? Excuse me, for a game like that.
Yeah. I've already mentioned one of them actually earlier on. I just didn't call it out necessarily.
Right. I would think that it's. I was about to say daily active users, but more or less like a percentage or a metric that is related to active users, because I wouldn't be surprised that. Out of, let's say, let's talk about monthly active user. Out of, let's say, maybe 15-20% of those users would get converted into sales of the new expansion. And you need to keep your conversion rate at every expansion high enough so it's worth making another expansion. So I would focus on more or less active users as a key matrix of success.
You're on the right track. Okay. So basically what you're talking about is retention. But there are actually three measures that Bungie states in their presentation. In order, they are trust, retention, and revenue. You forgot revenue. Okay. It's the most obvious one.
That's good. Yeah, I mean, that's why I guess revenue is kind of all underlying like retention rate.
Yeah. Let's go through these in order, starting off with trust. When Bungie released Vanilla Destiny 2, they sort of knew that there wasn't a ton of content in the game, but they assumed that Destiny 2 players, without anything to do, would leave and return in time for the next expansion. This is not what happened. Instead, players decided to stick around in Destiny communities, loudly complaining about how they have nothing to do, ruining the reputation of the game.
That's fun.
I was part of that group. And what also really sucked is that there were people who were full-time Destiny streamers in the Destiny 1 era who had their livelihoods threatened because they simply could not viably stream Destiny full-time anymore because they had nothing else to do. And they were especially cranky and they had massive audiences. So they also yelled really loud about how much Destiny 2 sucks. So to repair the damage of early Destiny 2, they actually completely revised their priority list for the first major expansion to address some of the most vocal pain points to make the community feel like they were being heard. Because honestly, if they had not done that, the game would have been fucked. Regaining player trust basically took an entire full year of effort. I remember there was a period a couple months after the release of Destiny 2, where every 2 to 4 weeks there would be a giant blog post or podcast, kind of being a complete apology from all of the developers who worked on Destiny 2, being like, here were the design goals for all of the decisions we made that you hate in the game. Yes, some of them did actually succeed in those design goals. Now, let's try to analyze how these design goals do not align with your player sentiment, and please talk to us so we can try to figure out like what the hell we do with this. And it was really interesting in the lead up to Forsaken's release, there was the only so far Destiny 2 community summit at Bungie headquarters, where they invited close to 100, maybe 200 content creators from the Destiny community and basically said, like, just give us all your feedback. Be as honest as you can. Tell us exactly what you think about all these things. We're going to pitch things to you. Please give us your opinion. We really want to know how you feel about this stuff. And that was also a big positive move towards regaining trust, because people could see that they were actually taking it very seriously and they were being very transparent. There was a podcast where they were like, everyone hates the new weapon system. Here's what we thought the weapon system was going to do, and here's how we failed with the weapon system. It was a really interesting period to be in the game, and I think even though it was a very, very low period in the game as a player, it was a fascinating time to be reading those blog posts and listening to those podcasts, because you rarely get that level of transparency into what is going on with this crazy game that's not, it doesn't seem to make any sense from the outside. Bungie even took a massive revenue hit by removing all microtransactions from the game. They said, people don't like microtransactions in general. We don't want to look like we're just making bank on microtransactions while the game is in this state, so we'll just remove all of them, because the risk of losing player trust was understood to be more significant than the loss in player revenue, which is a really noble thing, I think, because most companies would not do that. Next on the list, retention. You talked about it. We'll talk about exact metrics in a little bit, but that was the entire main goal of the Forsaken expansion that was released in September 2018. So basically a year after Destiny 2 shipped, they shipped Forsaken, and the entire point of Forsaken was fix endgame, ensure that there were plenty of long-term goals for hardcore players to seek after. No wonder it's remembered super fondly by hardcore players. I have to state for myself that I played the most during the year Forsaken came out. I haven't played more in any year of Destiny 2 since. And it was probably the single expansion most catered to hardcore players in the history of the franchise, which is normal because it was literally made for hardcore players because they were bleeding them by the second. Forsaken was not just a great expansion, but it was the expansion that Destiny 2 needed most at that time. And it's a really good expansion. Unfortunately, like, I can't tell you go play it because that has been vaulted out of the game. And I think I figured out why it was vaulted out of the game just before recording. So there was a change in who the publisher for Destiny was midway through Destiny 2. So Destiny 2, Curse of Osiris, Warmind, and Forsaken, which were the first year of content, first 2 years of content, rather, were published by Activision. And then there was a falling out between Activision and Bungie, and they basically decided to publish the rest of Destiny themselves. So I believe all of the content that Activision published has been vaulted out of the game, so you can't actually access it anymore. But everything more recent that has been published by Bungie is still accessible, which is interesting, but it also sucks because Forsaken was really good. Also, following Forsaken's launch, player trust was back on track and retention was recovering quite well, which means they could start focusing on revenue.
Now we're back to talk about money.
Yeah, well, we're only going to talk about it a little bit because it's not really that interesting, honestly. They only did a couple things. The first thing they did, so early on in Destiny 2, they used loot boxes for cosmetics, and everyone was complaining about that. And besides, there was a lot of legislation coming up in various markets about whether loot boxes were considered to be gambling or whatever. So they were just like, nah, fuck that shit. We'll just give you a shop of specific cosmetic items and you can pay for exactly the items you want. So you can still get engrams in the game that you can decode for random cosmetics, but you can't pay for them. Which was the main issue that they saw previously. And the other thing they did is they added a free-to-play entry point into Destiny 2 with New Light, which is the name of the free-to-play stuff, which launched alongside the Shadowkeep expansion. And this is what you played on Stadia when we played last time. It didn't really make much sense from what I remember. That's classic Destiny storytelling for you.
Oh yeah, I remember. I was like thrown, like I felt as a newcomer. I was just thrown in the middle of something, but never really understood what exactly.
Yeah, they still haven't really fixed that problem. Okay. But that's out of scope for the episode. But having free to play actually means that at least now your player base is much more massive. And if you have dips in popularity, you are dipping maybe the same percentage, but you are still going to have much more active players than you would otherwise. So we talked about like the high level metrics. Now let's talk a little bit more low level with the KPI report cards. Bungie internally has KPI report cards where they track all of this regularly. So for trust, they have two metrics: vocal sentiment, which is a numerical representation of how the community feels about Destiny as a whole. They also have rate last week. So they give weekly surveys to about 1,000 players to ask them how they enjoyed the last week of Destiny 2. And they have that on their dashboard. Then for retention, you weren't far off. Average daily active users is one of the metrics. New player rate, weekly return rate, which means how many people played last week and returned this week. And then weekly win back, which is how many people didn't play last week but returned this week. So longer term absence from the game. And then, of course, they have revenue, which is like the usual stuff you would expect: gross revenue, expansion revenue, microtransaction revenue, and average revenue per daily active user. Bungie actually said something really interesting with regards to revenue, actually. Despite measuring revenue, Bungie does not actively optimize for revenue because they know that will hurt player trust in the end, and that is more important to them than the juicing as much revenue as possible out of players, which is great to hear. And I generally trust Bungie's judgment with regards to microtransactions and their involvement in the game. Like, they haven't really had any major abuses so far, so I'm pretty comfortable with where they're at with regards to that. All of these metrics that I mentioned are monitored in different ways. There is daily KPI monitoring where anyone at Bungie can log into a dashboard and see these KPIs on a daily basis if they want. They have fortnightly live ops reviews, which are meetings every 2 weeks going over biggest feedback points with anyone who takes key creative decisions in the game. And they have seasonal recaps, which are post-mortem of a D2 season going over what didn't work. And they record these and archive them as a sort of internal training to understand the business of running Destiny, as a sort of Apple University type training thing internally, which I like. That must be fascinating. I would love to watch those. probably not going to happen, though. And with all these layers of data, you may be thinking like, they're data-driven design. No. Bungie says they are doing data-informed design, not data-driven, because if you let yourself be driven by the data too much, that limits creativity. But what they do is they give creatives the freedom to do what they do, but enough information to take informed risks and make hypotheses instead of playing it safe. So that's good, and that kind of closes that metric section. Okay, this is the part I had the most trouble with, because I don't think this analogy works, but it's their analogy, not mine, so complain to Bungie, not to me. Bungie used to be in the business of building trains, which is box products. And what they mean by this is they work until the release is just right, and then they send it out into the world. I kind of tweaked the analogy, because otherwise it literally makes no sense. Bungie is now in the business of running a train station. Their presentation says, we're building a train station. No, you're not building a train station. You're running a train station. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense. So what I mean by this is, at Bungie, there are multiple tracks with parallel releases at any given time. There are expansions that need to be worked on for the next year. There's four seasons a year, so if someone needs to be working on that... Your priorities are much more about coordinating to a schedule, being predictable, and no one should need to do any heroics to ship a season or an expansion or whatsoever. Delayed trains, in this analogy, don't just hurt that train. They can cascade and cause chaos to the entire train line. I'm sure we've been in situations where there has been this sort of cascading debt or whatever, and that's totally true. You've probably heard a Miyamoto quote that is probably a misquote, that a delayed game is eventually good, but a bad game is bad forever. And Bungie isn't really in agreement with that anymore. It's not that quality doesn't matter, but if you're fast and you're good at taking in feedback, you can fix a bad game.
That's an interesting take.
Yeah. It always depends on the kind of game you're trying to ship. But yeah, right. If you're a game as a service, you're more likely to be able to fix a bad game. You have to get comfortable with shipping things on time, but imperfect. And you never want to delay or ask your staff to overextend, because that generally always makes everything worse. And that's why we need to start talking about crunch, everybody's favorite thing in the gaming industry. Bungie says that on a live service, you're either never crunching or always crunching.
I hope they use the never crunching, because the always crunching is utterly bad.
Yeah, that's the goal anyway. And like, we've seen it. If you look at Fortnite, for example, there has been some journalism that's been done where basically if you work at Epic on Fortnite, you are always crunching and you basically never see your family because you have a strict schedule of stuff to ship and you're always behind because of cascading debt and all that shit. And it sucks. And Bungie basically went on to say that it's very dangerous to overextend and crunch on live services. Unlike box product games, if you burn your stamina once you ship your piece of content, there's no recovery period. You're rolling straight into production on another high pressure release, and that sucks. You basically have to maintain consistent output and you can't really overexert yourself ever. And if you delay things a week, you probably just end up losing a week of development on your other release and are forced to cascade the entire roadmap for a week, or lose a week of development time and try to make it up. That cascading debt leads to a culture in which you're constantly crunching. So in a live service mindset, you need to be disciplined enough to work at a consistent but sustainable pace for every release. And sort of the leadership people in the company need to constantly proactively try to identify areas where teams and individuals overextend, either because they're passionate about something or due to scope creep, and guide them back onto a never crunching path as much as possible. And this is really fascinating to me ever since I've taken more leadership roles at work, because like traditionally I've been working with people who are adhere rather strictly to the 9 to 5 or whatever schedule lifestyle. And they don't really stay over time but work and work hard on stuff. And last fall, I had something that I was working on and with someone else at work. And I found out the next day that they had stayed up until 1 a.m. to work on it. And I had to intervene and be like, I didn't ask you to work until 1 a.m. And I do not want you to feel ever like I am pressuring you to stay and work things at 1 a.m. Like, you can do 9 to 5 hours every single day and I will not be angry at you. In fact, that is what I would like. And please, like, don't overextend yourself like this. I think it's very much aligned with my personal priorities in life, which is I want my the people I work with and who are on my team to be comfortable and to not feel high levels of pressure and stress regarding their work. And it's very similar to my own personal mindset that, like, I really want to be guiding people back onto a never crunching path and sort of identify what these issues are that are leading people to pushing themselves too far and helping them pull that back, because I don't think it's good. Definitely not good long term. And as a team leader, I definitely do not want that to be something that my team members go through.
Agreed. I cannot say it better than what you just said. That's perfect.
Continuing on the theme of consistency, over-delivering is actually actively dangerous for a live service mindset as well. Every release is setting a pattern that will be picked up by the community and the players. If you do something like ship an expansion with 2 raids, the expectations will be raised such that people will be disappointed if you ship a game that does not have 2 raids immediately afterwards. And it's especially difficult for a studio like Bungie, where the box product mindset that they've been working with for so many years was all about over-delivering. They constantly want to over-deliver, and it's painful to tell your teams who want to give players above and beyond what they expect not to do it, because it will set them up for failure on future trains. And Bungie openly admits that it is one of the issues that they're grappling the hardest with, and as a player, I can tell. So I want to talk a little bit about over-delivery in yearly expansions, because to me, like, they talk about over-delivery, but they don't actually qualify if they mean that over-delivering is over-delivering quantitatively or qualitatively. Forsaken over-delivered in both. It kind of had to if it wanted to recover player retention. You created this void of content in Destiny 2 Year 1, and you needed to not only give us something for Year 2, but almost like give us an apology gift for Year 1 at the same time. And Forsaken, like, overcompensated. And, like, that expansion, it is actually nuts what they gave us in a year. I don't understand how it was possible. There was probably crunch. And like, they outright told us a couple of years ago, like, never expect another expansion on the caliber of Forsaken. You will never see anything that huge ever again. And, like, it's one of the most fondly remembered pieces of Destiny ever. So I understand that it sucks to be told, like, this is going to be the peak. But at the same time, like, I understand from a developer point of view. Like, it makes perfect sense. If you look at the other expansions that have released since Forsaken, Shadowkeep and Beyond Light are incredibly forgettable expansions with almost nothing memorable. And that's kind of the baseline we're working with here. Witch Queen, which is last year's expansion, it did not necessarily over-deliver in quantity of content, but everything we got was of the highest quality we've ever gotten in a Destiny campaign. I would even say I like it more than Forsaken. It doesn't have as much stuff, but everything that is there is much better than anything else we've ever had. Which is why it hurts that this year's expansion kind of went back to the baseline. Lightfall is slightly above the baseline in terms of mission design quality, but the actual story of the campaign is complete nonsense that feels like a waste of the player's time. And just to give some perspective, if you haven't played Lightfall, you can take the opening cutscene and the final cutscene and you can stitch them together, and everything that happens in between does not matter. It is completely useless, does not matter. Or at least if it does matter, it's not explained to you in the game how it does matter. And Bungie has said they are going to ship a mission next season that is going to explain why it matters. But it's a little bit late. And the explanation I want to give here is major expansions of Destiny are always the most widely played new content in the game. It doesn't matter how good or bad you are at the game or how hardcore or casual you are. Most active players will play a new expansion campaign sometime around launch. And the baseline or consistent level of quality for major expansion campaigns is simply not good enough. And importantly, contrary to a lot of the other things in Destiny 2, the campaign is not something that really benefits from being fast and being fixed over time. The campaign is the first impression of the expansion, and if you fumble it, you've taken a hit that is going to be very hard to recover from until the next expansion a year from now. How many times are your players going to be willing to be disappointed by a major expansion campaign before they leave? And what sucks, they were talking about like establishing patterns. Almost every time a Destiny expansion is really good and you start being really excited for where the game is going to go next, the next expansion is a massive disappointment. And there are only so many times you are going to want to lose faith in Bungie before you move on to a different game. And that's sort of the warning I want to bring out for Bungie, is there are a lot of things in your game that, yes, you can iterate on and improve over time. The campaign is not one of them. It is the closest thing you have to a box product in Destiny, and you sort of need to preserve some of that box product mentality to ship something that is of high enough quality to actually like get people to come back to the game on those big yearly milestones. And like this year, unfortunately, you kind of fumbled it, and everyone was really hoping like this is going to be the point where we're going to be able to tell our friends, hey, if you've been thinking about coming back to Destiny, this is the one, right? And it had a super cool like synthwave inspired 80s colors neon theme, visual theme that everyone was really excited for. We were like coming off the high of Witch Queen that had the best narrative in Destiny ever, and we were like, this is going to be it. It's going to be awesome. We're going to be able to tell our friends Destiny doesn't suck for once. And we had to tell everyone that Destiny sucks again. So that really sucked this year. And again, I fully understand from a developer point of view everything they're saying. It makes perfect sense. But this is ultimately an entertainment product, right? It's not just shipping features and shipping software. It's an entertainment product. And there is more to be considered than just, we made a consistent thing that is exactly like what we shipped for the last year of content. And yay, we can move on to the next one.
Right. When your video game is more enjoyable as a case study for, like, more or less like video game management than being a good video game, there's a problem about your video game.
Yeah, well, there's still a lot of stuff in Destiny that is really fun. Like, if the weapons weren't fun to shoot, nobody would be playing this game. But the thing is, it has the best weapons in any video game. So that's why people keep coming back. It just feels so good to shoot stuff in that game. We just want better excuses to shoot things. I think for the Lightfall story in particular, like, it's pretty bad when people who are full-time Destiny YouTubers who focus exclusively on the story of your game don't understand what the story of your expansion is. That's their job, and they don't know what the story of the expansion is. You kind of fucked up. And I think that that's everything I have to say about Lightfall. I mean, there was a lot of good fun stuff, and I think the mission design, it's a little bit below Witch Queen in terms of quality, but the missions were still pretty damn good. And there's a lot of cool system stuff that they did, but ultimately, like, that first impression is going to burn so many people that they won't stick around to care. Anyway, let's go back to the GDC talk for the last section of the GDC talk, which is going to anger me again, and I'm going to go on another rant.
You? On rants? Huh.
Yeah. So, this is their quote, not mine. Everything we deliver needs to be a blueprint. We need to understand how it will be repeated and how we can repeat it sustainably. If the blueprint can't be repeated, we need to manage player expectations so that they match ours. Basically, to avoid the over-delivery thing where you make people used to a certain type of activity or whatever, and then you're like, oh no, we can't do this anymore, just so players don't feel like it disappears out of nowhere and get pissed. An example of a blueprint that is cited in this is the Legendary difficulty campaign in Witch Queen. Destiny 2 campaigns, the difficulty stuff has changed so many times that it's hard to keep track, but basically, like, what difficulty in air quotes implied in the campaign mode prior to Witch Queen, they turned the numbers up. That's basically what the difficulty was. So you had to be higher level to kill stuff, but basically it was unchanged. Legendary difficulty adds a bunch of modifiers to the campaign to make it much harder. The enemies hit harder. There is like a fixed power gap between you and the enemies, so you can't overpower them like you can in the traditional campaign. There's a bunch of cool stuff. I played through the Legendary difficulty campaign with a friend in Witch Queen. It was a lot of fun. It was one of the most fun things I've ever done in Destiny. Highly recommended. And as they said, it's one of the best received features of the expansion. But they were like, moving from the old difficulty model to this new difficulty model is going to require a lot of additional work on top of building the campaign. And so to reduce the friction of adding legendary difficulty campaigns to future expansions, they documented how they went about it. And now Bungie can more efficiently design legendary difficulty campaigns for subsequent expansions. And this, in theory, is good, right? Or at least this example is good, because what this example is showing us is that they can slowly increase the baseline quality of yearly expansions by having repeatable blueprints of past successes. Where this completely falls apart is in seasonal content. So seasonal content has been released consistently every 3 months since December of 2018. We're currently on season 20. So seasonal content is probably the most iterated type of release in Destiny 2 history. It's just in a hyperbolic time chamber where they are cranking these out all the time. Unfortunately, we sort of get to see like the extreme consequences of what the blueprint approach is. In one way, seasonal content quality has gotten a lot better in the last year and a half. There were a lot of complaints early on in the seasonal model where seasons just felt kind of throwaway or disconnected from like what the story of the game is or whatever. It just felt like, I don't know, go throw some balls at enemies and we'll see you in 3 months. That's kind of what early seasons felt like. Now, narratively, seasonal content serves as a kind of B-plot that the game goes through between major yearly expansions. So if Lightfall is primarily an expansion about what's going on with the Witness, which is the main antagonist right now in the game, and Neomuna, which is this moon of Neptune that you discover at the start of the campaign, well, the seasonal content right now is about the conflict back on Earth. So it's kind of a B-plot for the yearly expansions, but contrary to what you would expect, like, because there are four in a year, you get different B-plots throughout different parts of the year. Recently, the quality of the storytelling in seasonal content has actually surpassed the level of the average major expansion, which is really impressive, considering that this is kind of like the budget team for Destiny content, which is kind of weird. Mechanically, seasonal content serves as a rotating endgame grind through which players can obtain new weapons and armor. And unfortunately, mechanically, seasonal content has become too predictable and formulaic, largely because everything became a blueprint. There are 2 to 3 patterns of what a season looks like, and we've all seen them many, many times by now, and we're ready for something else. There's a meme where you're going to go to the war table and there's going to be a grid of upgrades that slowly unlocks from week 1, week 2, week 3. And that's one of the patterns. There's another pattern, which is like, oh, you're going to have to throw a ball at a shield on an enemy to break the shield. Then there's another pattern, which is you're going to have to throw a ball into something that looks vaguely like a goal a couple times while shooting enemies. And like, those are the 3 main patterns.
Wow.
And it's like, okay, but do you have any other ideas? Because, like, as a developer, I get it. I understand the desire to streamline things, and I'm sure it's easy to crank out seasons every 3 months because you literally have the blueprints there, and I can see that it works. I have the proof in front of me. But as a player, I feel like it's been way too long since Destiny took any risks with the seasonal model and made something unexpected that delighted me as a player. I'm not really asking for more quantity or more quality. Like, seasons are $10 of DLC. Like, I'm not expecting the moon here. But I don't think I'm asking too much if I'm asking for more originality. I think it's funny because Bungie said that they weren't data-driven, but rather data-informed because they don't want to stifle creativity. But I'm thinking that whether they realize it or not, they're becoming blueprint-driven. And it's going to hurt player retention a lot sooner than they think because seasonal fatigue is at an all-time high. People are tired of the war table upgrades. They're tired of umbral engrams. They're tired of like all of these things that keep coming back every 2 or 3 seasons, and they really just want something else. And it's perfectly understandable because I feel the same way. So that sucks. It really sucks. Like, at the same time, I'm not the hugest Destiny player these days. I tend to mostly play like whatever season is live when I start playing the expansion. So right now I'm playing like the one that came out, season 20 that came out alongside Lightfall. And like, there's some cool stuff in there, but it's not massively wow or anything. And I see the patterns less often because I play one season a year instead of every season like some people. But I still keep up with what's happening in Destiny. I watch Destiny YouTubers. I see that it's still always the same thing, and I don't feel like I'm missing much because of that. So I totally get it, right? So that pretty much concludes the entire tour of the GDC talk that I was talking about. I think it's really fascinating to get a look behind the curtain of these live service games. I think Destiny is in a weird spot because a lot of live service games are exclusively competitive games. Like, if you look at Valorant or Apex Legends, or I can't think of any other games right now because my brain is mush. But yeah, like, a lot of these games are primarily PvP focused, and your seasons are going to be mostly cosmetics, couple map changes, and like maybe weapon adjustments and loot changes if we're talking about battle royales. And that's pretty much it. So Destiny has a lot more scope to cover because they have the whole PvE and PvP aspects to cover. They have gear that persists on your player, which is not something BRs have because you are just going to pick up whatever garbage is on the floor when you land. There are a lot more concerns that are exclusive to Destiny that make it a really interesting, weird edge case in this business. And it's interesting to hear how Bungie navigates that. But at the same time, they're definitive weaknesses. And this year, year 9 of 10 of the Darkness Saga, is the year where it is at its peak. And I think they need the most introspection in these moments to try and adjust this. Now, to be fair to Bungie, they have said that they are aware of the seasonal fatigue issues, and they are going to be addressing it in the second half of the year's seasons, because the early ones, obviously, were already too far in development to do anything about it. Which, again, sort of makes you think, like, well, you say it's all about being fast, but you're not that fast. But at the same time, as a developer, I understand, like, you can't just throw away all your plans and fix shit live while stuff is burning, right?
You can, but you'll be late. That's literally what will happen.
Exactly. So I guess, like, the transparency and the trust is at play here. Yeah, I don't envy Bungie and their position right now of trying to fix this. I think it's unfortunate, because I think everyone I know was really, 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 really excited for Lightfall. And we weren't looking for it to be better than Witch Queen. We just wanted something that was close. And it just undershot it so much that it really hurt. And especially for me, I played Witch Queen the month before Lightfall came out. So I was just coming off of it. It's not like I had a year of distance from it. I was, like, just coming off of it. I was like, oh no, this is so much worse. And it felt pretty bad. And I don't know. It sucks to be really excited for something and being so disappointed. And I think it's funny, because you think, like, Forsaken was exactly the right Destiny 2 expansion at the right time. Lightfall, honestly, there have been a lot worse Destiny 2 expansions than Lightfall, but it was exactly the worst Destiny expansion at the worst possible time, because you're always going to compare it to the last one, and it was such a jump that it just looks that bad in comparison. Like, I played the Dark Year of Destiny 2, year one, with Curse of Osiris, which most people rate as the lowest Destiny 2 expansion of all time. Curse of Osiris is so much worse. So, so much worse than Lightfall. Like, don't believe the Steam reviews. It was so much worse. But all that matters is what it is relative to what came before. And Witch Queen was a banger, and Lightfall wasn't. And that's why everyone's disappointed. That's it for me.
Good. So you can find the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/202. So 202. You can also find our back catalog of episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. You can find the show on the Fediverse by following at limipo_podcast at mastodon.social. That's limipo_podcast. You can find us individually there too. For me, you'll need to follow at Luco at Mastodon.social, and for Yannick, you can follow
at Sakarina at icosahedron.website.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.